Oh my God, 200 episodes of drama. Hey everybody, it's Connor. Thank you so much for joining us for this monumental moment in drama history. I am so excited for today's guest that I'm not going to take up too much of your time. But before we jump in, I just want to mention our Patreon, patreon.com/thedramapodcast. We call it Drama Plus around these parts because you get drama plus more, you get extra bonus episodes, and you get access to our Instagram close friends. $5 a month, you help support the pod. And listen, that $5 goes a long way, and we really appreciate it. It'll take us all the way to the next 200. So thank you again for joining us. You're going to love this episode. If you loved it, if you loved the twins, aka me and Dylan, definitely sign up for Drama Plus and leave us a review on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen, and tell all your friends about us. All right, without further ado, it's time for the show.
Press play, curtain of an hour in. It's time to take spin.
The shade and tea
to spill.
Ooh, drama.
Oh, that's a tweet. Did they book? Who got nominated?
They option no.
Oh, I'm not well.
What star will we talk to today?
Oh, that's a gag, honey.
Say no more. Drama.
Drama. Welcome to Drama, a podcast that covers theater,
pop culture,
love,
and life.
I'm Connor McDowell.
And I am Dylan McDowell. Connor, as we sat down today, I was thinking, this is our 200th time doing this.
That's so funny. That dawned on me when we were doing the intro. Mm-hmm. Although we have goofed it and have had to start over before.
But, it's true.
But oh my God, Dylan, congrats to you. I always do this whenever we celebrate an anniversary, but I'm like, we wouldn't be doing this without your persistence, your dedication to really getting this off the ground. And it's my favorite thing I do every week. So
I know. Well, I'm so excited. I can't imagine life without the podcast. You know, it's
what were our lives like before it? 3.5+ years ago.
I don't know. I would imagine our Tuesday nights were a little bit more social because that's the night before we upload everything for Wednesday. So, but anyways, it's been really an amazing journey, and we have a phenomenal guest today. But there is something that I know that you had wanted to mention, and that's that we ran into a listener on the street recently.
Yes, it was so fun. We were just walking home from Pride after the long weekend, and we ran into someone who was, you know, and we've heard these stories before. We've heard them in DMs or, you know, meeting people on the street before. But for some reason, because we were together, it really hit on the eve of our 200th episode recording for this listener, Miriam, shout out, to approach us and say, you know what? I love the pod. I'm obsessed with it. I've listened to every episode. It's gotten me through a really shitty survival job that I was trying to get through. And the conversations meant a lot to me. And Dylan, to me, that's my favorite outcome from doing this. Yes, I love recording and getting to know people and making connections, but the other people get a lot out of what we're getting a lot out of is so special. So thank you to all the Miriams out there. We love you. We would not keep doing this without you. And I'm so excited for 200 more.
I know. You know, it was beautiful. And like you said, it's those connections that we've made because, you know, we've been podcast fans for years and you know that we had an example of things that got us through situations or jobs or commutes. It's very nice to know that we're doing that for others. It's an intimate thing, letting someone into your ears week after week. And so thank you to everyone who has been along with us on this journey. And we're going to celebrate today with a massive guest who we could not be speaking with today if it weren't for our dear friend, Annalie Ashford, who connected us. I mean, there's no introduction necessary, but because we always do it, we have to read in our guest. Our guest today, here to celebrate 200 episodes, is the queen. She won a Tony Award in 2015 for her performance as Anna Leonellens in the Lincoln Center Theater revival of The King and I. She has earned 6 additional nominations throughout her career for her roles in The Bridges of Madison County, Nice Work If You Can Get It, South Pacific, The Pajama Game, The Light in the Piazza, and Kiss Me, Kate. She also appeared on Broadway in Sweet Smell of Success, Follies, Dracula, and Jekyll and Hyde, as well as off-Broadway in King Lear, Brigadoon at New York City Center, and the recent Ragtime concert as Mother. She is Mother, by the way. For her immense talent, our guest was awarded the prestigious Drama League's Distinguished Achievement in Musical Theater Award in 2019.
She received an Emmy nomination for her portrayal of Katie Bonner in the hit web series The Accidental Wolf and currently appears as Aurora Fane in The Gilded Age. You'll recognize our guest from 13 Reasons Why, All the Bright Places, Peter Pan Live, Sex and the City 2, Masters of Sex, The Good Fight, and more.
Our guest has become a regular in Metropolitan Opera performances, including The Merry Widow and The Hours as Laura Brown. She is a frequent performer on PBS's live telecasts, the Kennedy Center Honors, including the Barbara Cook one, and alongside the New York Philharmonic and the New York Pops. This Grammy and Olivier nominated performer also has albums available now on Ghostlight Records. You can currently see this megastar in Days of Wine and Roses at the Atlantic Theater now through July 16th.
She is a star, a mother, a gift, and a goddess. Please welcome to Drama, Kelly O'Hara.
Hi, Dylan. Hi, Connor. I'm so glad to be here.
Thank you for joining us. As we, you know, hyped up beforehand, we are just so honored that you are here on the podcast today.
I am too. Thank you very much.
I wish our listeners could see you because you look absolutely stunning.
Thank you. The power of technology.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yes. We all have those nice filters on our Zoom. Thank goodness. But
Kelly, how are you doing? Are you well?
I am well. I'm very well. I'm artistically really satiated right now. Tired. And it's the good kind of tired, the kind of wrung out tired. So yes, I'm very well. Thank you.
That's amazing. Yeah. So as we mentioned, you're currently in Days of Wine and Roses at the Atlantic Theater Company. And, you know, I know it's extended. It's this new musical. What can you tell us about that show? I'm so curious because is it an original musical?
It is an original musical, although based on, there was a film in the 60s and a teleplay a little earlier than that. You know, oddly enough, it's a beautiful story in my life. I was doing a show called The Sweet Smell of Success back in 2001. And I love Brian D'Arcy James, creatively, artistically. I just admired him so much. I had seen him in Wild Party before that. And I just loved working with him. And Sweet Smell closed a little prematurely. And I randomly got chosen to go out to Sundance, Utah and do a theater lab. And that's where I met Adam Gettle and all the people working on The Light in the Piazza for the first time. And I just had this, I knew the film, Days of Wine and Roses. The subject matter is important to me. So I said to Adam, you should write a weird opera musical version of Days of Wine and Roses. And 21 years later, and I said for Brian and for me, because that was, we had been in this era. I loved working with him. I wanted to work with him again. 21 years later, we're doing the show. So that's the story of Days of Wine and Roses. So it's good to have patience.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It truly pays off. That's so incredible. And obviously you've worked with Adam Gettle in the meanwhile, but what has this experience been like now, 21 years later, actually doing the damn thing?
Well, you know, it really teaches you to take risks and to ask for things that are interesting to you. I never would have known if I could do it, if it's the kind of role that I should be playing. I would never have been ready to play it when I asked him. You know, I'm glad the time has passed. It's taught me a lot about what I still have to offer. It's taught me a lot about what I still have to learn. And I just feel overwhelmingly grateful right now because it is such a, to work on an original piece at all is such a beautiful learning experience. And here we are. And I find myself, you know, the pandemic did a lot for us where it kind of took us down in certain ways and made us question in other ways. And to find myself right in the center of something extremely creative right now feels like a phew, you know what I mean? Like there's still stuff going on and I'm so grateful for it.
Yeah.
I love to hear it. I need to come see it.
Yeah. Come see it. It's a very important, but very, very hard and dark story. And I know that I sometimes provide and present the joy in, you know, the meaning like Rodgers and Hammerstein revivals and things like that. People come and see South Pacific. And I've said that I love, my husband always says, go spread the joy and meaning, you know, go do something that makes people escape for a while. So some people do not expect this because it's a very hard character. Mm. But for an artist, for somebody creative, I think the outside world needs to remember that what we are doing is an act of pretending. And it is an act of searching and stepping into other shoes. And so for me, this is the most joyous work probably I've ever done. But for them, it might not be so joyous to watch. But it's also, I think some people walk away and it's incredibly important to them. You know, we have a lot of people who are sober, who come and are very grateful. We've all been touched by alcoholism. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all have one arm's length to it. And I think that anybody who comes gets something deep out of it.
I didn't even realize that was the subject matter. I mean, you're talking to two Irish Catholic boys. So hello.
Hello, brothers.
Yes, I know. That's really powerful. Wow. And you know, it sort of reminds me of like pieces that have maybe gotten a lot of attention have been able to zero in on things that are really happening in the moment. And I feel as though maybe alcoholism is one of those untapped areas. And I wonder why. I mean, Next to Normal was all about mental health. And I can't really think of any pieces right now. Although we see it in television, where I don't know if you're watching The Bear on Hulu.
Well, I haven't. I'm not watching, but I'm aware right now. I just haven't had my evenings are taken up. But it's so funny you mentioned that. But Tom Kitt just came 2 days ago to the show, and he's a dear old friend. And I think about Next to Normal a lot because it is kind of getting inside a story. Alcoholism is something that people have struggled with since the beginning of the time. Mm-hmm. But I think that the pandemic so deeply put people in a questioning place. What is my relationship with alcohol? I don't know about you, but I had a lot of friends get sober. Mm-hmm. And then I lost two friends to the moment of, I can't do this anymore. And their addiction took over. And so because of the loneliness of the pandemic. And so it's funny when you say, I want this show to be made. And then for some reason it takes 21 years for it to be made. And then it lands at just the right time. Because I think coming out of this pandemic, people have had a different relationship with alcohol for sure. Because literally in the pandemic, what else did we have to look forward to? 5 o'clock hit and I was like, let's have a cocktail, you know.
Right. We were just talking about this.
I mean, really, honestly, you're sitting inside your house and boy, the liquor stores, they were doing well. Mm-hmm. I'll just order some, you know, I'll order a shipment.
Oh, yes.
And so I think that it's the right time. And these topical things, that they aren't for escape, they're for searching and journeying and learning. And I love being a part of one of these little pieces that take a real subject, a real problem, and make art out of it so that we can learn something.
Wow.
I love too what you said about how your husband always says to go bring the joy and bring
spread the joy.
I think that can be found at the end of these maybe darker stories too. You know, it makes you examine your own life or maybe get some perspective in the process. So you're still doing that. I know it.
Yeah, no, I think the joy in this is not just all the creation of it and sort of the artistry, because Adam's score and the direction and the book, and it's just working. Brian is a genius. Also, even though it's a hard ending, and I'm not giving anything away, it's not a tied up in a bow ending. But the joy, I think, for some people comes out of the fact that they watch this and they say, thank God that's not me, or I'm going to make sure that's not me, or something like that. And there's a joy and a relief in that. So yeah, there's joy in all of this art because it makes you feel. And if you feel, then you grow, you know.
100%. And I love art that isn't tied up in a nice little bow too. That's I don't like being told what to walk away from it with. I think my favorite kind of art is the kind that makes you think and gives you things to talk about with other people and look inward. So I'm so excited. I need to come see it before it finishes up for sure.
Do you know, I mean, the Atlantic Theater just won Best Musical with Kimberly Akimbo. Do you think there's any life beyond this for the piece, or?
I have nothing to say confirmed, but I really do think that it's been blessed with a bit of a move. I don't know what kind. Again, you know, we talk about Tied Up in a Bow, which makes it makes it less commercial. But right. I do think it's an important enough piece. And what always surprises me is when people take that risk, like Next to Normal, Fun Home, when they take the risk to do something like this, it usually always pays off, at least artistically. And sometimes theater is worth it, you know, even if somebody doesn't make a mill, you know, or whatever, it's worth it to do it for just the history of that's how I feel about this show. I feel like it's important. And so, of course, I do. I'm doing it. But mm-hmm. But yeah, please come see it. And if you have trouble, call me. I'll get you some tickets. If I can.
Is this really the first time you've worked with Brian D'Arcy James, though?
Well, no. We've never played. We've never done a full show together. But
okay.
Over the years, in fact, we've gone back over how many times we've collaborated on, whether it be a recording of something or a gala, or we've done concerts together. So we've been together and friends and working together all these years, but we've never played again on the stage together. So
wow. Yeah. Oh, I remember goodness. You both were on 13 Reasons Why too, and yes. Playing around the Kate Walsh storyline. But did you guys ever act together in it?
We had a couple of days for one scene together. He reminded me of that. I'd forgotten about that. We did. We showed up at one day, but I just did it a little bit, but he was on it much more than I was.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny. I always love when theater people show up on, you know, Netflix shows or more mainstream things. Not that theater isn't mainstream, but you know what I mean? It's always like, oh, those are my people. You know, I know them.
That's why the Gilded Age is such a treat for all of us theater gays too. Oh,
I mean, the Gilded Age is like my dream come true. You know, I'm just sitting there with all my theater heroes but yet we're doing something different. We're doing television and it makes it, I don't know. It's been fantastic. Season 2 comes out in September.
Finally, we've been waiting, Kelly. You know, it's going to be worth it.
We've been done with it for a long time and the editing process has been, but I think that, you know, they have to figure out when to put shows out and when to place them but get everybody, you know, to watch it because we want a third season.
Yeah. So. Yes. And now it's on Max as with the name has changed.
Yes. Max.
Can you tease anything about season 2? Cause you know, season 1 was so brilliant. I mean, I would have watched an episode every single day, like the soap opera if I could have.
It was water cooler television.
The conversation pieces. You know, I think season 1 had to get started with all the introductions and you had in the best thing. I mean, I think season 2 is riveting. I think that what they did was all the characters now. So then they just went deep. The writing is deep. There are so many really interesting storylines now. And I mean, right away when we read the script for season 2, I thought, now we're cooking. Now we're cooking. It is like, you know, I just really need ideas and important ones. So storylines have expanded. They've gotten deeper. They took turns you don't expect. So season 2, I think, is going to be great.
Oh my gosh. I'm excited. There's some new Broadway folks joining for the second season too. I'm trying to remember. Was it Laura Benanti that's joined?
Benanti's on board.
Yes.
We had some fun days on set until 4 a.m. I think maybe I didn't post it, but I just have a picture of her lying on the floor somewhere in the 3:30 a.m. hour, just being like, no.
In period clothing, of course.
Well, of course, in corset. That's why I think I'm lying on the floor to try to get some breath.
Okay, so we've been chatting about some things that you're currently working on. And, you know, you mentioned South Pacific earlier, and that was the first time I remember becoming familiar with you. It's seared into my brain watching you on the PBS filmed version, but also at the Tony Awards. Mm-hmm. And that was at a time when my brother and I were getting into the arts ourselves, involved in school. And we like to ask all of our guests about the time when they got involved in the arts. And we borrow the term Ring of Keys from Fun Home because we think of it as a moment of recognition when that light switch went off and maybe you were watching something or, you know, maybe you were in choir or something like that that really got you into the business as more than just an interest and maybe thought, oh my God, I need this as a part of my life in a huge way. Do you feel like you had a Ring of Keys moment, Kelly?
Well, I mean, gosh, I think we all have, if you perform, you know, you don't even know what that is. I mean, I'm still learning at 47. You know, people say, well, how do you choose your jobs and whatever? And we don't get to choose them as much as you think. We kind of take what's there and then we try to pick between which would be best for us and everything. But really, you don't know what you're capable of. You think you could be until it's put in front of you. And so I'm going to go all the way back to being 10 years old and having no idea about this business. No, I grew up in Western Oklahoma. I didn't visit New York until I was 21 years old. Guys, I didn't watch the Tonys until I was about 22. I didn't know about it. Nobody told me. Nobody introduced the idea. Really, it was Kristen Chenoweth who went to OCU, studied with the same teacher, who went to New York to make a name for herself. It was when she won a Tony for Charlie Brown that I was like, oh my God, look at this. You know, this is amazing. I came to all this pretty late, which is why I'm this age and still so hungry for it because I started a little later. But when I was 10 years old, I had watched all the Julie Andrews and Shirley Jones movie musicals that you could possibly get on your television. And that's it. There was no live theater. There was nothing. And so when I sang for a talent show, you know, 10 years old, I sang That's What Friends Are For, Burt Bacharach. Just in my romper or whatever it was with my hair. You know, I remember going, you know, they clapped. Something came out of my, I didn't even know I sang. I just decided to sign up. And I remember thinking, I've just found my place in life. I've just found it. And then I did, you know, I did school musicals and I did this. And when I went to college to study music, and by the way, I don't know if things are meant to be, but I had heard about this woman, Florence Birdwell, my voice teacher, since I was 5 years old. I was like, I'm going to go study with her. And when I did summer stock and I met people who were working in theater, I just thought, I didn't know you could make a life doing this, but I've just decided I'm going to. And I didn't know what I was going to do, and I didn't know why, but I just did it. It was just such a, I think ignorance is such bliss if you just let it guide you until you learn. And then, I mean, not certain kinds of ignorance, but the ignorance of
like, I know what you mean.
The ignorance of not being afraid, you know, like you don't know how hard it is. So you just leap, you know, and that was, that was where I was. I didn't know New York was, I just thought, yeah, I'll go, I'll do that. And and it was all those little things that sort of led me here. And, but anyway, yeah, I mean, I've had many rings of key moments where I thought, gosh, this is, I'm going to do this, you know?
Yeah. And you've gotten to perform probably a lot of those roles that Julie Andrews did or things like that, that, I mean, you've done the canon, as we like to say, but I'm curious, the moment that you actually got to work with Ms. Birdwell and meet her, what was that like? You know, sometimes they say, don't meet your heroes. Sometimes they say, do, you know, as you said, she'd been in your orbit forever. What was that first meeting like?
Well, she just took, God, it was like a tornado hit me in the best way. It was like she sweeped me up into her orbit and took me out into a world I never knew existed. It was the world of unabashed emotional freedom. You know, she ripped me apart. Believe me. I mean, I think about mentorship these days with kids, and I think about the unfortunate abuse of mentorship, or abuse of power, I should say. It's not a mentorship if it's this way, but the abuse of power that sort of soured us on the idea of strong mentorship, the kind that's positive but hard. And Mrs. Birdwell, if I hadn't had her, I mean, she was just as serious and as honest as all get out. And she took me down several pegs in order to get me to where I needed to be. You know, you come in and you think you know a lot. And one of the things she helped me do was to just rip away, you know, such insecurity, such walls. But if I had been afraid of that or offended by that because of the fear of it, of the fear of learning, of being humbled by it, then I wouldn't be here today. She really just changed my life and made me a stronger woman. I think that that's the unfortunate thing about really the ugliness of insecure power, you know, the type of people that lord power over you because they're so broken and insecure. Whereas Mrs. Birdwell was a pretty full person. She did all of that because she wanted me to be the very best I could be. She wasn't trying to take anything away from me. The better I was, the better she was. I mean, that's leadership, right? So
oh, absolutely.
Yeah. What we have now is we have a bunch of people. And we did back then too. I just got lucky. She wasn't one of them. And I knew the difference. I knew the difference. I definitely had teachers that I could tell. I could sniff it. I could sniff it out. Yeah.
For sure. I knew who she was since I was like 12, 13 because of you and Kristen Chenoweth, you know, pushing her out into the world for all of us to know about her talents and her incredible mentorship. So you went to school to study music. When was your first theatrical production that you did?
Well, I did go as a musical theater major. I mean, I was in high school doing the musicals, that kind of thing.
Okay.
But, you know, there we did Carousel. We did Hair. You know, we did something. But I went for music, and then she switched me to opera. She really, I mean, listen, as much as I tried for hours on end in my bedroom to sound like Whitney Houston, it just wasn't going to happen. I mean, I tried to scream, I did everything, but all that came out was this soprano voice, zero belt, zero. And so she switched me to opera, and ultimately, foundationally, that was best for me, but it wasn't my love. It wasn't my first love. It just was what was easier to sing. And so when I moved to New York, I was going to go to master's for opera, and I just didn't want to. I walked into a room one day, my senior year of college, and I just was so conflicted. And she took my master's program application, and she just ripped it up in front of my face. She said, go to New York, go follow your dreams. But I had taken so many acting classes and things, but I was so determined to be a better actress to go along with my singing that I moved to New York, and I enrolled at Strasbourg, and I went to acting school there for a while. Mostly because Audra McDonald had. And, I mean, we all have our heroes, don't we? We all have our. I spent all of my career studying to be a better actor. Like every show I did was an acting experience and a learning experience. I'll be working on it for the rest of my life. There was no technical skill that I got and then headed into the world. I mean, the technical skill is your everyday lesson, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ooh, wow.
That's so powerful. I love that you're like a student of life. It's really, really beautiful.
Oh my God, I've learned more over the last 3 or 4 years than I've learned in my entire life. What I was talking about earlier, the humility and to admit that you have a lot to learn and to not be defensive about that, to not be afraid of that, to know that you'll be better for it. that's really important to me. And it's a real frustration that's getting in so many ways, so many people's way.
Yeah,
for sure.
Especially our politicians. But anyways, Connor and I have so many different credits that we'd love to talk to you about. And so we only do this sometimes, but I was curious if you'd be down to just sort of share a memory or something, if we were to list off a credit, a memory that is evoked from us just mentioning something that you've done.
Yeah, let's do it.
Whatever comes to mind.
Yeah.
Connor, why don't you pick one first?
Well, I mentioned it earlier, but South Pacific was the first time I was familiar with you. And what was that experience like for you when you look back now? I mean, how many years ago was that? Like
14.
14?
Yeah, well, because my son's 14 and I was definitely pregnant with my son during that.
That's right.
That's right. I remember reading about that. You know, as a young kid, our parents took us to the city. We actually couldn't get rush tickets to South Pacific because you needed a college student ID. And we were like in high school or something. But I remember reading about it, who knows where, probably on like Broadway.com or something, an interview with you about how they adjusted your costumes because as you were going through your pregnancy, they wanted to, you know, keep you in the show for as long as possible. Or maybe you wanted to stay for as long as possible. I don't really know how that worked.
Oh, I definitely wanted to stay. I mean, it started to become hysterically funny because I looked like a whale running around in a swimming suit. But I mean, I stayed until I was five and a half months pregnant, you know, in that stupid, well, they gave me a one piece, but she wouldn't even let me wear shorts. I was like, are you kidding me? My backside is growing as well. But she, anyway, I did it. And people that saw the last bit of it, but didn't know I was pregnant, I'm sure thought something was a little weird.
What do you remember most about that time?
Well, you know, Danny Burstein, such a gentleman. I remember I didn't tell anybody until I was 12 weeks, which is kind of the time when you're supposed to maybe finally be comfortable telling people. And so there I was doing that, but certain parts of my body were growing and because that's what happens. And finally, Danny and I were behind the big, where we do Honey Bun, big theater that on there. We're behind there hiding, ready to come up. And he kind of looks at me, you know, and this is about 9 weeks in. And he goes, all right, what's going on? Because he's a father himself. Yeah. I was like, don't you tell anybody. He's like, your secret's safe with me, but I knew, I can tell. And so he held that secret with me until I could tell everybody. And it was so nice to have that sort of just so somebody knew. And in case on the days I wanted to throw up or because that happened too. But you know, even before that, because that was toward the end of my run, that show was just so extraordinarily positive. And, you know, Barack Obama was running for president. It's amazing how sometimes we were just talking about with Days and Bride and Roses. Things fall in at the right time. And here we were doing this show about bigotry, you know, about just where we were. I say where we were in World War II, but, you know, but it was an important thing to kind of go deep inside that and how to tell this particular story, how to play this role. Nellie Forbush, who you want to love her, but she has a lot to learn. And I'm proud to play those roles. You know, I don't always want to play those roles, but I was very proud to play her and to see her change and evolve.
For an audience, that's nice to see as a character who is imperfect and does have things to learn and grow from. It helps you in the story see them go from point A to point B, and hopefully the audience has maybe changed a little bit with Nellie. So,
yeah, no, it's a human thing. It's a human thing, and it's okay. I think she should be a symbol of a lot of things, you know, how you're raised and then what you do with it, you know.
Yeah. And your voice on that cast recording is beyond. Speaking of, I mean, I'm obsessed with your voice. Here's the moment where I start to like rave about you, Kelly. So you can like, I don't know if you're going to, you know, love this or hate this, but the Bridges of Madison County cast recording, which I never got a chance to see the show, but it's in my probably top five all time favorite Broadway cast, probably actually recordings of anything. It is so stunning. And you just sound glorious. Oh my God. I'm obsessed with it.
Thank you. I'm so proud of that. I mean, that was another one that started from its very inception. I mean, Jason and Marcia Norman and I sold the idea before it was even written. He wrote it. Because there I was trying to find, again, I'm constantly trying to find scores that I can sing fully and free because I don't, my musical theater sort of thing is not, I'm in between, you know, and that's okay. I'm very proud of that. It, you know, what makes you different, you know, but I, you know, the fact that he wrote that just for me so that I could find real ways to emote without having to, you know, really pop it up or anything. You know, I wish I hear it and I wish that I could more. I hear it and I think, oh, if there could be more chest in that sound or whatever, but I'm not going to spend more time on it. But I was so proud of that particular score and that experience until this moment, you know, I would always say that that is the most important thing I've ever done, because it, again, it put me in a position to learn what I can do that's a little bit more. I mean, the character, this sort of Italian, earthy, grounded, real mama woman, you know, not, mm-hmm. not a kid, not an ingenue anymore. That was a part of my life where I was really transitioning into, for lack of a better word, into something different and more whole of myself, not trying to recapture the past. You know, we all need to just go forward and find out what more we have to give, as opposed to defending a legacy, you know, of being Nellie Forbush or Clara or something.
Yeah.
Bridges gave me that gift of growing up.
And you were brunette, which, I mean, always helps get a little bit more serious. In the
It's so funny you say that, because I realized at one point, like maybe this year or last year, I'm like, huh, I don't really play blonde anymore. Nobody wants me to play blonde anymore. It's because when you get older, blondes don't really happen, right? I mean, it's so annoying. It's like I can only be brunette or redheaded. And then, of course, for Days of Wine and Roses, they got me back. And Kiss Me, Kate, but we didn't start that way. But they got me back in a blonde wig. And I thought, wow, that's... blondes only exist for young women and sort of starlets, like, or like aging mm-hmm. starlets. And I thought, that's stupid. I mean, we're not just, you know, we don't just have to be things can be in all packages, you know?
Yes.
100%. 100%.
Oh my gosh. I think that score is just remarkable. I mean, to build a home and almost real, the way that they sort of stand at the beginning of each act is these pillars of your character. Were those songs difficult to conquer?
No, that's what's the strange thing about that for me. First of all, I should just give a shout out to Steve Pasquale, because I've worked
with
amazing leading men in my life. And wow, I mean, that building that with him was pretty remarkable.
He said the same about you, I must say. We had him on the podcast at one point. Well, we asked him who he'd ever want to work with again, and he mentioned you.
So. I think we'll always be looking for each other. I mean, we've known each other since we were, you know, 21 years old or 22. Or the score itself, that's the thing that's weird. People ask me the same thing about Days of Wine and Roses. Like, it's so hard. And that's the thing. For me, that sort of singing is where I feel alive. That what's hard for me is South Pacific. And I know that sounds weird because it seems simpler, but because I'm not a belter. Like, I did the pajama game where I was like, or whatever. Sorry, that was really loud. But that's more of a challenge for me in the long term. Whereas to sing soprano, to sing full and open, that's just naturally what feels right to me. And, you know, when Jason first wrote the score, he was writing that earthy stuff that Steve, all that beautiful sort of folky, earthy stuff. And he was writing that for Francesca as well. And I remember saying to him, wait, you said you're going to write this, you know, this isn't what I'm good at. I love it, but it's not the best. And he came back the very next workshop with To Build a Home. And I remember opening my mouth to sing it and it falling out of my body. And I think thinking, this is the best song this is my favorite song I've ever sung in my life. And I still feel that way.
Yeah. Oh, and the way it builds that, the ending of it, it's just remarkable. I love that last note that you, I was just listening to it last night, of course, you know, doing my best Kelly in the car. And it's, you know, it just sits so right in your voice. It's just so remarkable. I know you say you might've wanted more breath or anything like that, but you know, you were carrying a show. I know you were a new mom at the time, or for the second time, or
talking about South Pacific being pregnant. In this one, I just had my baby. And so I was about 2 months postpartum, and just, I don't remember the whole experience as well as I'd like to. I've always wanted to go back and do it again, because I was just, any mom would tell you, I mean, your whole body is just weird and loosey goosey. And, but in a way that also informed the character, you know, especially sexually, you know, she's feeling lost in that part of her life. And she's wondering, is this body enticing to anyone anymore? You know, am I appealing in any way? And here's this man comes along, and, you know, it did inform how I played her. And I was heavy. I was heavy into the ground. And I think Francesca definitely was. So I think of it all as being very, I was very grateful, but I had to pump during, sorry to be too, but I mean, I had
no,
this to pump
is
during intermission every time. Because in the second act, I had to be in a bathtub, and it's a, you know, I'm going to write a book about it someday, that the comedy of trying to make all that time that out just perfectly. I mean, I was a mess, but at the same time, you know, it made me, you know what it does? It makes you just drop into the realness of something and not worry about it technically too much. I was just so emotional and heavy, and that it fed the character, I think.
Yeah.
Was there nudity in the piece?
Yes, I was completely nude.
Oh my goodness. I did not realize that. As someone who's never seen it, I didn't realize
that. Not that I should have been, you know, she's in the bathtub and it's that moment. It was a devastating moment. She gets out of the bathtub and she's in the mirror and she's like, she's thinking about it because she's met him and she's wondering. I mean, think about anybody, think about yourself when you've met someone and you think, I mean, it's going to make me emotional. And you think, am I worthy? Would anyone want this? And I was in a place in my personal life too. I just made a person in my body, and my body had all the beautiful, beautiful attributes of that. And yet to have a new partner come into your life and, in that show. And so in that way, I mean, I had a towel and I was sort of draping it, but at the same time, it was so exposed. And we decided that we would do that part of it because it was really scripted that way. And I could have shied away from it. And I was like, whatever, let's just do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Was that a musicalized moment? Was that one of the songs in the show too?
No, it was. Well, no, okay. Of course it was. I wasn't. It wasn't. Hunter Foster, who played my husband, was away, that they go away that weekend. That's why I have this moment. And I'm not condoning these types of moments, but for Francesca, it was definitely a breaking open point. But he's at the bar where he is, and he's really singing about where they are in their life, you know, what's happening. And then over split stage, split screen, literally, I'm at home having met this new person, this new man, and I'm questioning where I am in my journey as an older sort of a mom. And so you have these two thoughts happening at once.
Well, listen, Kelly, you know, considering Meryl and Clint in the movie were older, you and Steve could totally do it in the revival when it's, you know, coming back in. So
you know what? It might be a first, and I love the idea. I'm going to just say it out loud. Steve and I would love to just, and rethink it, restage it, I think the whole thing probably could use a rethink, and because the score itself, you know, speaks for itself, I think. So yeah, we've actually talked about that a lot.
Yeah. I love to hear that. I love it.
That's so great. It's got to happen.
Yeah. For sure. Well, speaking of leading men who sang your praises, we also had Will Chase on the pod, and he's obsessed with you, and you guys did Kiss Me, Kate together. I'm curious about any fun memories or what you think about when I mentioned Kiss Me, Kate to you.
Oh my goodness. You know, I love to do these darker pieces, these more sort of thoughtful pieces. And then I always want to go find the biggest, stupidest musical comedy I possibly can. I mean, my most fun memories are Nice Work If You Can Get It, Pajama Game, you know, South Pacific in some ways. But Kiss Me, Kate was so joyous. It was joyous for me. The cast was so beautiful. We were just in hysterics all the time. My kids would come. They still think about, you know, they don't really understand how this business works, where you have this really intense thing and then it just disappears. It goes away like of a cloud. And they keep saying, like, why can't we go back there? You know, they used to spend time with the cast and in my dressing room. They so miss that cast and all those people. And Will and I just, I mean, again, we've known each other for eons. I still laugh when I think about how much fun. Every night, it was just hijinks. You know, we're just trying to make each other laugh, screaming, yelling, slamming doors. It was one of the most fun times I've ever had.
Oh, I love to hear it. It was a joy to watch. We were in pretty much the back of Studio 54, but it came all the way back there, you know, like that, the joy, the choreo, the vocals. And now this one's a little bit more topical, which I don't know if you got the chance to see Light in the Piazza that was just done, but we have to visit that. I feel like for many of us theater people, that was a moment where you sort of, it felt like you as a performer had arrived on the scene as this complicated character. What do you remember about that process?
Well, going all the way back to my version of it, because what I loved about seeing, I had to see a rehearsal of the encores that just happened with my dear Ruthie. I had to see it. I couldn't miss it, but I had shows every night. And Vicky and I wanted to go see the Sunday night performance together, but I was away that weekend out of town. And so I went to see a rehearsal. It filled me up with the idea that this piece is just so well written, so beautifully done, almost perfect. And to have been a part, as I'm watching it, I'm like, to have been a part of this inception means so much to me. And in fact, I mentioned earlier on that I got randomly placed in it. I was going out to Sundance to that theater lab to do another project in 2001 or 2002. And they just needed someone to stand in this new workshop of a half done musical called The Light in the Piazza. Ted Sperling, who was the music director, just said she can do it. And then I played Franca. I was Franca for that. And and Celia was Clara, Celia Kingdom.
Right.
And I knew right away, I was like, I think I found my home. I think this music, you know, because it was that art song. It was that sort of like classical art song. Because Franca, in fact, I said to Adam, put a high F in it. I told him, I was like, make her sing big, operatic. Because I was doing Franca. I was invested in Franca at the time. It was just to get to say things like that. Why don't you do that? Why can't I, can I say this instead? And then put it in. And then we did it in Seattle and we did it in Chicago. And we kept building it and changing it and building it. And so by the time we arrived on Broadway and I had moved into Clara and all things like that, it felt so rich, but also so complicated. It was a complicated thing. And so it wasn't until we did a 10-year anniversary concert. It wasn't until that moment when I just relaxed and enjoyed it and said, now I know how to play this girl. You know, now I've had some time to think about it. I was almost 40. and so when I saw this version at Encores, I was overwhelmed. I was shaking, crying. I sat with Adam in the audience to watch this rehearsal, and the two of us were just, I just looked at him and I said, look what you did for us, you know?
Oh my goodness.
And that was your first Tony nomination, right?
That was, yes.
You mentioned that theater itself didn't totally come into your life, and watching Kristen Chenoweth win her Tony kind of got you into it. So I guess, you know, for me, I'd be like, oh my God, I finally won my Tony. I've been dreaming up since I was 9 years old. But for you, what did that feel like?
Listen, I mean, this is the honest truth. When I got nominated for Piazza, it was like fireworks had gone off. I didn't think about, and this is the honest truth. I don't even think you really contemplate like winning at that point. And then as the nominations were coming over my life, I started going, well, it would be really fun to win. I hope I win. And I wouldn't make a speech, but when I would go jogging or something, I'd be like, and I just want to thank my parents. You know, I'd have all these conversations with myself about,
yes,
definitely Mrs. Birdwell, you know, because Kristen got to thank Mrs. Birdwell. And I remember how special that was. But that first one had none of the good thing I'm saying about it. It had none of the pressure of like, the pressure started happening more with each nomination with no win. It started being like, okay, well, maybe I'm terrible. Maybe I should, and so that first one was so free of anything but joy. I remember going that year and just being like, you know, we're just and performed and it went great. We were just happy. And I mean, I think of that as just the most joyous time. And I was so proud of our show because it was the little engine that could. Nobody, you know, at first it got all these mixed reviews and we didn't know if it was going to be okay. And then, you know, by the Tonys, we were just so thrilled, you know, so it was just heaven. It was heaven. Yeah.
And that was a cool year too, because the love was really spread around all the different awards.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And then every single role since then that you played or originated, you've gotten a nomination for. And then you finally won in 2015, which I can only imagine was extra special because you were nominated alongside Kristen. Like, it was just so many different elements there. That night when, you know, they're getting to your category, did you think, oh, it has to finally happen now?
You know what? I absolutely not. And I'll tell you why. I was okay. You know, the calm started coming after Bridges. I was like, it's okay. I love what I do, you know, and this is, it's hard. You know, you think, well, it would be so awesome, but you don't remember. Maybe you do because you have all this, you know, all these things, but, you know, I remember I saw Kristen in the beginning of the Tony season, and we both got nominated, and she took me by the arms and we hugged each other, and she's been a mentor. I mean, she got me my first agent, you know, I mean, I owe Kristen everything. And she took me by the arms and she said, I want this one to be yours, is what she said to me. I was so moved by that generosity. But the truth of the matter is she was killing it in her show. I mean, she was literally brilliant in that show. And she won the Outer Critics Circle Award. She won something else, the award. She won the Drama Desk Award. And by the way, I wasn't nominated for a Drama Desk. Usually, oh, wow. Leading up to the Tonys, you might have the nomination for both of those things, among other things. And sometimes the person who wins the Drama Desk Award will win, you know, whatever. I wasn't even there. I didn't get a nomination that year, which was the first of time for my nomination seasons.
Wow. But so you really were just kind of like.
I'm not just saying that. I went that night. I remember saying to my parents, who had been there every time, I was like, sorry, guys, it's another, and it's fine. I mean, this is such a celebration. I'm so proud of what I've done. And so I can't invest in that because it's not going to happen this year. And I remember going backstage, doing the number, doing the big quick change, doing the whole number.
Oh, yes.
Sort of shaking. And the guy who always did my hair, Chad Harlow, amazing guy, he was doing my hair. And he looked back into to get back into my gown to go sit down to have the whatever. And this is something I was so used to. I'd done it six times by now. And he's looking at me in the mirror and he's brushing out my hair and he starts to cry. And I think he was crying because he either knew I wouldn't win or he thought maybe I would. And I don't know. We've talked about it since. And he was like, I don't know. It felt really heavy in that moment for you. And I went back to my seat. And I don't know why it was heavy in emotion. And then when they called, that's why when they called my name, I was like, my gosh, I finally gave in to the fact that it just, and knew, because the other years I thought maybe I could win. There were some other years I thought maybe I would. And, cause you always hope
Bridges, you were robbed. I mean, love Jessie Mueller, love her performance, but you know,
that was another one that I thought probably I wouldn't, cause we closed prematurely.
Right.
So I was, again, I mean, there are many times when I've given myself good pep talks, but, but that one, I just was okay. And then, so the fact that I won actually just my heart exploded, you know,
but. And then you did the worm backstage at,
I know, I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know what I was talking about. It's just, that's how excited I was. I was just making nonsense, you know, but it was a beautiful moment.
Yes. And so deserved. And just, I mean, I think the room probably roared with just joy. And it was your time. It was for you, as Kristen manifested. And she was even hosting that year, right?
She hosted that year. She was killing in her show, just everything, you know, and she was so lovely about it. So
that's special. I mean, you both will be nominated again. I mean, you already have, but you know, more to come.
Do you feel like winning the Tony opened up any new career opportunities for you? I guess I've asked guests this before and they've answered it's been a mixed bag, you know?
You know, I've heard comments like winning the Tony's the worst thing that ever happened to me. You know, it's an amazing, it depends on where you are in your life. I think, you know, I think if you're Ben Platt and you win the Tony when you're in your 20s, then it's like the world is, you know, your oyster. I think if you've had a career that spans a while, and I had by this point, you know, you say, well, can't hurt, but I think you're also sort of established in sort of your path. I don't want to say, I know that it never hurt. The only thing it could possibly hurt you is that you have this expectation after that to like only choose big time role. And you shouldn't get caught in that. You know, Sutton's a great example of that. You know, she won one Tony and then went and played a smaller part in something else. And then of course got nominated again, but
yeah.
You shouldn't take the pressure. I mean, I've never done that, but to take the pressure or let your management or your agents take the pressure of, well, now you've won a Tony, so we can only do these types of things. The most important thing is to choose to just stay real, stay in the center of the art and the craft, because to think that the Tony is going to sort of create some sort of stardom or some sort of big, you can pretend it does, but staying, for me, this is just for me, staying humble and like in my work had to be the main thing for me, because that's what's important to me. And choose good things, choosing really good things, and not just choosing star vehicles for, you know. For me, it's just, I feel like it was sort of balanced. I mean, I felt really wonderful about the moment. And then I didn't worry too much about like, what does this mean? You know, I didn't go be a movie star, you know, not by choice. I mean, sure, but it didn't change that much, but I'm sure it didn't. It has not hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very well said.
For sure.
You know, I'm thinking about how you mentioned your kids were born throughout this period of you already being a working actress. Do they have favorite roles of yours?
Well, they loved, like I said, they loved Kiss Me, Kate. Mm-hmm. They just thought it was cute. My son actually has seen Days of Wine and Roses. It's my daughter's too young for it. And I thought I wasn't going to let him, but he insisted and it's a little dark for him, but they love that. And because I did King and I all through their youth, I mean, we did it in London, we went to Tokyo. They really have a soft spot for that whole show too. But when you think about it, they've been pretty young during my career. Yeah. So they don't know the first parts of it. And honestly, I'm mom. Yeah. And they don't, so I want to make them part of my career, but I want them to also have me as just a mom too.
For sure. Does your husband have a favorite role of yours?
You know, he always used to say it was my life with Albertine. by Ricky Ian Gordon. It was when we first started dating. And it's so funny. He's sort of a theater snob. You know, he's not a big musical comedy guy because he produced real theater, you know, you know, Odette's plays and things. But he loves it all. He really loves it all. But actually, I think that he really likes Days of Wine and Roses. I think he likes the more play-ish, you know, things. He's always liked that kind of stuff more. But I'll ask him. I'll report back.
Yeah, I don't know. So we gotta get Greg on the pod. What would you love to do next? Like, if you had any choice, would you take something to Broadway? Would you take Days of Wine and Roses Broadway? Would you star in a movie? What is your next dream?
Oh, God. You know, when people ask, it's so funny. I think people do have answers like, I want to play. I've never had that answer. And what's interesting to me about it now in my life and the position I'm in right now is I used to say, I'll know it when I see it because it's going to be written, right? And so things like Bridges, things like Days of Wine and Roses, these things are being created and they end up being my favorite thing. So I'm not ready. I don't want to say, oh, I'm going to play Mama Rose or, you know, whatever it is. And because until people write more Margaret Johnsons, you know, it's like, what is there to do? What is there to aspire to that hasn't already been done in the most glorious ways? You know, maybe reinventing something, maybe it'll happen. Maybe some role that's already been done, but I'd rather go into new territory. And that can be TV and film too. I've just enjoyed doing The Gilded Age so much. So we'll see what happens with that. But I just don't know it until I see it. And I kind of like that. The TV schedule is obviously a lot easier.
Sure.
Oh my God. So that's the theater thing is hard, but I'd like to see Days of Wine and Roses have a short Broadway run for sure.
Yes.
You know, limited engagements are all the rage these days too. So listen.
And it's easier. It's easier and it's more financially, you know, viable.
Yeah.
I'll start dreaming up theaters. Okay. So we're sadly wrapping up here, but we do like to end on a dose of drama, which ties in the titular segment. This is sort of like if there's anything on your mind or your heart or anything you're thinking of as we sort of end this 200th celebration episode. Connor, do you have a dose of drama?
Well, I came in with one and now I have another because I was like, am I going to be corny or am I going to be like fun? Like, you know, like a little more dramatic, but I have been binge watching this show on Netflix called Glamorous, starring Kim Cattrall, and it is so fun and stupid, but funny, and oh my God, I'm obsessed with it. It's kind of like Ugly Betty meets Younger meets, I don't know, it's like kind of, it's campy for sure, and like super queer, and I cannot get enough of it, and I want more like stupid, silly things in my life, so highly recommend Glamorous, although I am feeling dramatic about one thing. They didn't make Kim Cattrall's character campy enough. She's too nice. She's not like a Miranda Priestly in Devil Wears Prada enough for me, or Wilhelmina Slater in Ugly Betty enough for me, but still love it, and I think everyone needs to go watch it for sure. Dylan, do you have a dose of drama? Oh, you need to watch it, by the way, Dylan.
I know, I haven't
started yet.
I'll give a quick one. Connor and I saw the Eras Tour, the Taylor Swift concert tour last weekend in Cincinnati. I'm still recovering. Full update to come on our Patreon page, patreon.com/thedramapodcast. Kelly, to bring us home today, do you have a dose of drama?
I do. I just got the screener on my phone for Joyride.
Oh.
And Ashley is such a dear, you know, from our King and I days. And so I really wanted to watch it. So I watched it on the way home in the car last night. And I just have to say, it's just funny. I mean, I actually laughed out loud and the driver in the front seat was like, what are you doing? Like several times. But for the most part, I mostly just sat watching it like this with my mouth turned up in a huge smile. And it was so many funny things Ashley did, but the people around her, all the different people in the movie, I think it's a lot of fun. I really do. It's a fun, funny movie. So
I'm excited to hear that.
I know. Kelly, Dylan called me last night and he was like, wait, I just saw the trailer for Joyride. We have to go.
Yeah. See, it's right. I mean, it's launching. So mm-hmm. Just got a little preview, but wow. I thought it was so much fun.
I love to hear it. Well, we've had so much fun with you today, Kelly. Thank you for agreeing to do this, taking a little trip down memory lane, and also kind of looking ahead to see what possibilities might be out there. This really was very special for Connor and I.
Thank you. And I look to see all the exciting things for you, too. And congrats on this podcast and all you're doing. And anyway, we'll stay in touch, I hope.
Yes, we absolutely will. Everyone can follow you at Kelly O'Hara on Twitter and Instagram. We're at the Drama Podcast. Connor is at Connor McDowell. I am at Dylan McDowell. And Connor, for the 200th time, I will see you next time.
Drama.